Hello and welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm David Rutledge. I'm keeping the seat warm for Andrew West for the next 3 weeks, and it's great to have your company. Today we hear from a distinguished recent visitor to Australia who perhaps took on a little more than he bargained for.
I think I was quite naive when I came. I thought I'd kick back, visit the beaches and teach a little bit. It ends up being that I found myself in the eye of the storm, so to speak.
His name is Aftab Malik. He's a British Muslim scholar, author and publisher. He's currently a designated global expert on Muslim affairs for the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations. And for the past 18 months, he's been scholar in residence with the Lebanese Muslim Association in the Sydney suburb of Lakemba, where many of Australia's first wave of Muslim immigrants settled in the 1970s. Now, the Lebanese Muslim Association is one of Australia's oldest and largest Islamic community organisations, and Lakemba is home to a very ethnically diverse Muslim population. As we've just heard, Aftab Malik thought that his stint with the LMA might allow him to hang out at the beach and enjoy some of that fabled Sydney lifestyle. Instead, he found himself taking on a hectic schedule of community work, involved in a mix of projects that ranged from youth leadership training to role model programs. Well, we'll be hearing from Aftab Malik in just a moment, but first, let's visit the streets of Lakemba and hear what people have to say about some of the big issues currently facing Australia's Muslim communities.
I don't think there's like any problem going on with the community, but the thing is that there are some people who don't want Muslims to go forward.
The main issues are the non-Muslim people just targeting the Muslims, calling them terrorists.
Islamophobia.
Islamophobia.
Yeah.
Is it something that's affected you personally, Islamophobia?
Personally, no, because I live in the areas where Islam is dominant, so I felt safety here. I don't get attacked. I do sometimes get like the jokes like terrorists because of my religion, but that's usually from other people who are Muslims and they're just making a joke about it, so it's a better way to deal with the Islamophobia that is present in this country.
I think if you talk about Lakemba specifically, I think it's a very good suburb for Muslims because we have halal food, there's a good Muslim community, and the thing I like about being here, actually being in Australia, is that people are really respective of scarf and everything, the hijab. So yeah, I think it's a really good place for Muslims.
Well, I've been living here for the last 12 years, so I haven't really faced any issues.
You haven't faced any issues?
No.
Everything's fine?
I think so. I mean, there are some issues about, like, you know, when you read all this news and everything, people think that the Muslims means terrorist or something like that. And that's the impression you get when you keep reading all this news. But that's not the case when you come to the community, you know what I mean? And if you walk around all these issues, everyone is busy with their business, their life, their social life. No one really has got time to actually spend on something else.
Just getting on with their lives.
Because everyone has moved on here for a better life, for working, everyone works hard, and then they can earn money, they can look after their family here, and then back home as well.
Voices from the streets of Lakemba, where British scholar Aftab Malik has been working for the past 18 months with the Lebanese Muslim Association. Well, last week Aftab returned to the UK, but before he left, he dropped by for a wide-ranging conversation about comparisons between the Muslim communities here and in the UK, about extremism and how to deal with it, about where to go to get a good Islamic education, and about his recent experience as a community youth worker in Sydney.
I would probably see myself as a mentor more than anything else, simply because of age and experience, not because of wisdom or anything like that. And, you know, human experiences, it teaches you life lessons that cannot be taught in a classroom. Because of my background as an educationalist, you know, I can bring that sort of academic vigor to a classroom, but something that is rooted within the Islamic tradition itself.
And is it the case that they brought somebody in from the UK because people like that don't exist in Australia?
The Muslim community in Sydney or in Australia at large is a relatively young community. So they haven't had the years to produce individuals who are indigenous to the Australian culture and have had the time and space to study their religion in some sort of detail. So it's really to do with the evolutionary cycle of the Muslim community more than anything else. And what I teach for the last 18 months is a means to address these tensions that arise, such as Islamophobia, such as mocking the Prophet, such as understanding Sharia, such as understanding terrorism, and where it stands in regards to Islamic law.
Well, let's talk a little about comparisons between the communities in Australia and the communities in the UK, because Muslims in Australia started to come here in significant numbers during the 1970s. And so our established Muslim communities are roughly, I think, a generation younger than in the UK. What can Australian Muslims learn from British Muslims in terms of dealing with the issues that are facing all Muslims in the West today?
The challenges that Muslims are facing here are not so dissimilar to the challenges facing Muslims in Great Britain. And given the trajectory in which they're going, I'd say that they're actually at an advantage because they can see what went before. So, for example, when the crisis occurred after 9/11, the Muslims in Britain, we have many Muslim institutions. So they can see, you know, how is it that they articulated themselves? What were the educational requirements to address these issues? But it's about capacity because they are a young Muslim community. I'm coming from a religious background when I say this, that people actually need the space and the people to go and study their religion authoritatively as opposed to authoritarian, as opposed to the authoritarian streaks that are vying for positions of authority within the Muslim mindset.
You've spoken about a certain maturity among UK Muslim communities. What exactly do you mean by that? How is that maturity made evident?
I think that 7/7 was a wake-up call, which was the terror attacks in London in 2005. Prior to that, many people, I think, were either oblivious to, you know, just simple pray times five times a day, avoid alcohol and pork, and then suddenly Islam was placed in the limelight. And so many, many Muslims had to go back and study their religion to be able to make sense of this. And they, once they did that, they were able to articulate that to their neighbors. And the discourse went from the length of one's beard and halal food to a discourse within the principles and philosophy of law, the Sharia. And unfortunately, it required a tectonic event for us to really realize and step up to the plate and say, look, come on, this is really serious. We really need to be able to articulate and express and engage people on a much higher level than we were before. Again, we talked about the comparisons between British Muslims and Australian Muslims. I, in my classes, urged my class, I said, you know, don't wait, don't allow something so grievous and harmful to your society for you to wake up. I said, you need to step up to the plate now, understand this religion on a deeper level.
Well, one thing that's come as a result of 9/11, the events in London and many other events in the last 10 years, is this idea that Muslims in the West are being victimized. And while on one hand, I don't think you could argue against the idea that Muslims in the West are under a great deal of pressure, if you look at the Australian picture, we have taxpayer funding for Islamic schools. Muslim voices are freely heard in the public square. You see police and politicians getting together with Muslim leaders to address their problems. All that being the case, how victimized, how isolated from the mainstream are Australian Muslims really?
Well, there was a report issued in 2011 called the Challenging Racism Project. It was a 12-year survey enlisting the most prominent universities in Australia. And their 12-year survey concluded that 48.6% of Australians harbour anti-Muslim sentiments. And unfortunately, with repeated sensationalised coverage in the media of the impending threat or the threat from within, it creates a problem in that the two communities that should be engaging with one another, you see a wedge drawn in between them, either through the murderous criminal acts of individuals who are projected as representatives of the mainstream. And this is what is causing frustration within the community. They are criminals. They do not represent us. They are fringe. But increasingly, that is being interpreted as they are lurking at every mosque corner. And also, anti-Muslim hatred or Islamophobia is a global phenomenon. And even in Europe, for example, we can see statistics ranging from 23 to 66% of people holding anti-Muslim sentiments. As I say to the politicians I talk about, it's not a short term, it's historic.
And on RN, you're with the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm David Rutledge, and I'm speaking with British Islamic scholar Aftab Malik, who's just finished an 18-month stint as scholar-in-residence with the Lebanese Muslim Association in Sydney. Where do you go in Australia to learn more about your own faith, to learn more about Islam? Where do you go?
We don't have to go anywhere. All of the information, it's in a holy book, Quran.
But don't you need to be taught how to interpret the Quran?
Well, yeah, there are books for that as well.
In a religion, it says clearly that you need to read Quran. I mean, it does not say that you'll have to go to someone, listen to someone, and whatever he says, and take that as a sole truth. It says that every Muslim's responsibility to understand the Quran, so it does not get misinterpreted. People can't manipulate you, you know what I mean?
So does that mean that what they're being told at the mosque isn't necessarily good teaching?
It's not necessarily mean that it's truth, because the people who is praying at the mosque, how do you know that they're telling you the truth?
Number one, you shouldn't look at the internet and media, because you don't... You
shouldn't look at the internet?
No, you don't know. Like, a person wrote that, you know? You don't know. Like, you go to the books that you believe in, whatever the books was, or ask leaders that you trust.
And you have leaders that you trust here in Lakemba?
Not in Lakemba, mostly overseas, because I'm new here, like, it's my first year here. But I believe in, like, in overseas, that even the whole Islamic thing, like, there are scientists that are very famous. They get, like, our Islamic scientists, because everyone trusts them, you know?
You can go to the mosque, and you can also just go to classes. I know that a lot of people in this community have Arabic classes where they do teach the religion and how to speak Arabic, so you can learn the Quran, which is, like, our Bible. I think you can also go online. You can just learn about it there.
I guess the trouble with online is there are a lot of people online on YouTube who are peddling a style of Islam which is maybe very extreme, maybe not orthodox. So how can you be sure that you're getting the right education in Islam?
Education. Well, it just depends on where the person stands. You've got to draw the line where you think it's appropriate and it's not. And I think that you can adapt the religion to your life, like I have. I'm not a big Muslim, but I do believe in not drinking and not attacking people, respecting people, being nice. That's the kind of stuff I do believe in, and not stuff like homophobia, that women should be submissive, and just attacking people in the name of God. I don't believe in that.
Aftab, I'd like to ask you about some of the community work that you've been doing among young Australian Muslims. What are some of the questions that these young people have been coming to you with?
Oh boy, they range really from the religious, talking about whether one needs to follow a school of law, to the cultural, you know, how much of culture should one incorporate in their identity, to the philosophical, in questioning whether or not Sharia has a role in the modern world, to the theological, to asking questions about evilness and death and destruction in the world.
One thing that I saw you bring up in a previous interview was an often heard question is, should I go to university here in Australia or should I travel to an Islamic country to study Islam? Does an Australian Muslim have to go overseas to get a good education in his or her religion?
It's to do with authenticity, the idea that it's the Middle East where Muslims live and have lived historically. There are some historical vestiges left, such as Al-Azhar University, which is the base in Egypt. It's the Sunni bastion of orthodoxy. And so it's a very common question. I asked that question myself 20 years ago. Do I need to go overseas? And the answer is increasingly no. No, for one reason, it's increasingly unsafe to travel overseas. And there's a lot more at stake than simply yourself. There's family, there's your safety. And so I encourage students to stay here, stay close to home. I encourage them to go to university, to participate in society and study their religion simultaneously if they're able to do that. I actually do not emphasize leaving university education and going overseas to learn Islam because it's increasingly complicated. And also with the ever-pervasiveness of this literalism that is unfortunately has spread like a cancer in the Muslim world, you know, one cannot be too sure if you're sending students to an institution where they will have an understanding that will be very relevant to them. Because a lot of students will go overseas and come back with a decontextualized understanding of Islam because it's simply textual.
But will students get a good contextualized grounding in Islam in Australia? I mean, one of the things that I often hear it said from Australian Muslims is that the talent pool among the imams in Australia, among the scholars, is a little shallow.
Yeah, it's strained to say the least. That's what I would say. And that will go back to what I said earlier. And that is the Muslim community here are relatively young. They need time to evolve and grow. In America, you have the Zaytuna College. And in Great Britain, you have the Cambridge Muslim College. The Muslims have been in a presence there much longer than the Australian Muslim community here. But again, what the Australian Muslim community can do is tap into those individuals and tap into those students to create a cross-fertilization of ideas. And that's what I am part of that process of cross-fertilizing these ideas that I have been taught and I have been living with for the last 20 years and bringing them into Australia. And effectively what I saw myself as doing is striking a conversation by asking very pointed questions.
Well, I think there's a fear among non-Muslims that if you study Islam in that sort of social and historical context, that what you learn, among other things, is how to resent the West. You know, I wonder if it's possible to have an Islamic education that doesn't instill a certain sense of grievance and injustice. Or maybe if you think that a certain sense of grievance is appropriate, you know, given the history of colonialization and Western intervention in the Middle East.
Islam does not teach you that. People teach you that. There is no religious education curricula that I'm familiar with that says, in the name of God, the most merciful, most kind, you must hate all the non-Muslims, despise Australians or Americans. Australians, individuals do that. The education process is there to create an Adamic human being, to transcend the lower self and to ascend to something that is great. The first thing that I was taught, it's called a hadith, which is a tradition of the Prophet. So my teacher taught me, the first lesson I taught was the following: the merciful are shown mercy by the merciful one. Show mercy to those on earth so that you may be shown mercy by the one in the heaven. And the idea, why, I asked my teacher, why was I taught that first? Why is this the first thing? He said, because everything that follows has to come back to this issue of rahmah or mercy. So that is classical Islamic education.
Last year, I was speaking with your fellow British scholar of Islam, Mona Siddiqui, and she was telling me that there's very little critical study of the Quran or any open-ended theology of any kind being done in the Islamic world today. And I thought that was an extraordinary claim. Do you agree that that's the case and that it's a concern?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the classical text, there is a great deal of critical theory that was undertaken by many of the classical scholars.
Many centuries ago.
Yeah. Many centuries ago. So that's interesting that they were doing it then, but why has it ceased now? They were very critical of terminology used in the Quran. They were asking, where did these words come from? From the science of hadith, we had a massive science of criticism. It was called jahh wa ta'dil, and that is weighing these individuals, verifying whether or not these things were authentic or fabricated or misconstrued. And that took place from the 3rd to the 10th century. The process slowed down. It's not coincidental at the same time that creative thinking was on a decline in the Muslim world, which coincided with colonialism at the same time as well. So many factors, historical factors that one needs to look at. What I've been trying to do is introduce to the modern world classical Islam. And that encapsulates a moral philosophy, a grounded theology, and a dynamic legal process of thinking. And I would argue that there's been a breakdown in this transmission of this authentic knowledge that had been codified, but through the last 3-4 centuries, dimmed and diminished and was abolished and replaced by an ideology of hate and rage and anger. And that's what I want to distinguish between my students.
But I wonder if there's a sense in which devout Muslims are justified at being wary of critical approaches to the Quran, critical approaches to Islam. I mean, if you, I guess my point is, if you look at Christian Europe over the last 150 years, there was this great wave of secularization that really began with critical study of the Bible, and people were looking at it sort of archaeologically and digging up old texts and saying, well, maybe Moses didn't write the first 5 books of the Bible after all. And I think you can draw a trajectory from there to the point where now in Europe you have dwindling congregations in Christian churches, you have the end of Christendom as a political entity. And I wonder if Muslims maybe look at that and say, well, we don't want to go down that road.
Regarding religion in general and Islam specifically, Muslims have no problem with criticism. I mean, historically, you can see the Christian polemics that took place in the 9th century in Damascus, for example. They're pretty vitriolic. The texts are all there preserved, and you can see these criticisms and then the rebuttals and counter-criticisms. So they went on. Criticism was never squashed in the Muslim world.
That's interesting. There was a dialogue of the kind that maybe we don't see today.
There was a dialectic. There was engagement. There was a preserved in the text. So it's not me saying it. You can go to the museums or the libraries rather and see these texts that have been preserved.
On RN, this is the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm David Rutledge, and I'm speaking with British Islamic scholar Aftab Malik. Aftab, I'd like to turn to extremism, the problem of extremism in the Australian Islamic communities. In 2013, you said that you perceived a sense of unease among Australian Muslims that reminded you of how British Muslims were feeling just before the London bombings in 2005. Now, that comment was foregrounded in the media in a way that you might not have intended. What did you mean by that sense of unease, and is it something you still feel?
It was a sentence that was said in a larger context, and what I explained was that the unease was regarding one's place in society. Like, where do we fit? The idea that somehow our Australianness is doubted. The unease was, these things are unfolding in the Middle East. How do we respond? How do we understand the apathy of Western governments to the impunity in which Muslims are killed in the Middle East? How do we respond to that? Where do we go for a legal and theological anchorage in something that is authentic and is guiding, that will elevate us and help us resolve these issues? The unease was of the economic downslide in which many of the Muslims in the area were facing. Unemployment, the fact of the matter was that many of these people were finding it difficult to get jobs. And I said, this is very dangerous, that where you face a population which you have a huge amount of young Muslims trying to answer these questions and navigate these very turbulent waters against a backdrop of political instability in the world.
As you prepare to leave the country, how concerned are you about extremism among Australian Muslims?
Thing is, I believe that it's blown out of proportions. It really much, it's quite sad. So, like, for example, if you take the Australian Bureau of Statistics, they gave an interesting study between 2002 and 2012, 850 people were killed by acts of domestic violence, and over 8,500 people were killed in car accidents, compared to 113 people who died from terrorism, 88 of which were overseas in Bali. You have over 500,000 Muslims, of which less than 43 people have been arrested on terror charges. It's a small minority of criminals. So my fear isn't from extremism. My fear is of this marginalization and this wedge that is being driven between a disenfranchised community and the wider society, who are led to fear this community. That's where my concern is.
Some groups, though, are willingly marginalising themselves. We have groups in Australia like Hizb ut-Tahrir that refuse to condemn the actions of extremists, and they refuse to be part of the democratic fabric of Australian society. I'm sort of holding back from using the expression Team Australia here, but you can see where I'm going. I mean, they're a small group, but I think they loom large in the national consciousness. What should be done about a group like that? Because there's been talk of banning them in the UK and here in Australia.
Now, that is a very interesting question that you ask. I mean, Hizb ut-Tahrir, or in English, it's called the Liberation Party. First and foremost, they have a spokesperson, so I cannot obviously speak on behalf of themselves. And they're more apt in that than I could ever dream of being. And you have to understand the party. The party was created against the demise of the Islamic Caliphate, which they would argue was destroyed in 1924. And so it was written against a backdrop of colonialism coming into the Muslim world and dominating every aspect, the political, the cultural, the economic, and the religious spheres. So this is against the backdrop of which Hizb ut-Tahrir was formed. And so they've taken that now into downtown Australia and Sydney over here, where they believe this siege mentality still exists, where Muslims, wherever they are under siege. Now, Hizb ut-Tahrir is interesting in the sense that they will call out very troubling truths. For example, the role of foreign policy. There's been a systematic attempt to de-link foreign policy to the causes of radicalization. That doesn't help anybody, because what it does, it infuriates the mainstream by saying, look, every single person has these killers, these murderers. They're always quoting foreign occupation as one of the causes. And so Hizb ut-Tahrir will talk about this and say, look, the governments, you know, they're not interested in what you're doing, because they will give you picnics and they will give you museums and schools. But the thing at the end that matters, they would ignore.
So you think their message is an important one?
I think that with regards to Hizb ut-Tahrir, people need to engage them on ideas. You know, they consider themselves as intellectual agents for change. And so rather than dehumanizing them or mocking them, we really need to engage. And I've been here since 18 months, and any invitation that I have with them, I've sought to engage them on the platforms that were granted publicly to them. And really it's coming from frustration. Let's be honest, you know, the West has created a model in the Middle East for the last 100 years. And the blowback from that is occurring right now, because these individuals that live here are living with the historical consequences of actions that took place 100 years ago. And many Westerners don't see that because they're from Europe. you know, compared to the Middle East, relatively ease. Everything here is very clinical. You know, death is a regular occurrence in the Middle East. People have to live with that on a daily basis. And Hizbet Tahrir will look at this and they will pinpoint with precision. And it does create a resonance with those seekers who are trying to make sense of this duplicity in international relations and politics.
On this issue of young men going off to fight in the Middle East at the moment, in Iraq and Syria, it's generally assumed, I think, that they're falling prey to some sort of pathology. They're all potential terrorists, right? But if you look at the context in which this is taking place, in many, maybe perhaps most Western countries, you have high unemployment among young Muslim men, you have a sense of threat to their culture, and of course you just have a yearning for excitement and adventure that all young males have. I wonder if you agree that there are strong parallels here with young men going off to fight in World War One. It's an interesting sort of comparison. It turns the picture on its head to some extent. Is that an interesting way to look at it?
It is. I mean, it's heroic. This is what they're doing. They're doing something that is for good, inherently good, and that is to defend Muslims. People want to go to Syria because they saw the ineptitude of governments not able to move quick. And so we've got a tragedy that's been going on for 4 years, almost 4 million refugees. You know, what kind of state are they doing? And so it was a case of doing something about it. You know, there is an urgency within some Muslims to do something. What is that something? That is left to them and their circles to determine. Some people will give charity, but there are some individuals who say, look, this is just not right. We have to go. And many people that went to Syria, as in the case of Great Britain, they went to help resolve this issue, ended up being usurped by the various sectarian infighting that was occurring. And now up to 80 people want to come back, for example, in Great Britain, which is causing a dilemma. What do we do with those individuals? And the Prophet said, he said that, you know, this sedition is like it's very alluring to the young people. It's like a young woman seducing a young man. But when he goes and embraces her, she turns into this ugly person, of which the grip is hard to let go, of which she has him under a grip. So seduction is certainly, I would say, is part of the process. I would also argue the fact that they believe that the politicians have let them down.
We often have these discussions about Islam in the context of extremism and a sort of public wrangle over the meaning of Islam. If we shift our focus to personal lived experience, can you tell me a little about the role of faith in your life? What does being a Muslim mean to you?
It's really to do good for humanity. I mean, the idea is that human beings have a demonic aspect and we have an angelic aspect. And really, when we tap into the angelic, we become Adamic human beings. As the Prophet said, mercy, have mercy with one another. The human tendencies are being eroded by the political mess in the world today. There's a great deal of darkness. And religion of all faiths, I'm not saying of Islam, is to create enlightened human beings. If a religion is telling people to go and kill people, I believe an inversion has been created within that faith. The idea of faith is to elevate, to bring society together with all its disparate parts. People of faith should be the glue of society, that, you know, they would work with anyone, they welcome anyone, people with faith or no faith. Because we're talking about a transcendental truth that has a transformative power. That transformative power needs to be utilized for good.
And on the Religion and Ethics Report, you've been listening to British Islamic author and publisher Aftab Malik, who's just finished an 18-month stint as scholar-in-residence with the Lebanese Muslim Association in Sydney. And that's it from us this week. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and sound engineers Marty Peralta and Michelle Watts. Don't forget to check the website where you can podcast, share or comment on our stories. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and look for the Religion and Ethics Report on the program menu. That's the program for this week on RN.